Hello and welcome to episode 15 in the series of podcasts featuring university registrars talking about stuff. This time I'm talking to Steve Denton, who's registrar and chief operating officer at Nottingham Trent University, about a variety of big ticket items in higher education at the moment, including, of course, matters pandemic. We look at Steve's long career in the sector in a series of institutions where, for one reason or another, he's been involved in mergers or the consequences of them, including some significant governance challenges, and the fact that they all seem to change their names after he's moved on. The prospect for new mergers in the sector looms large, and we also cover the response of Nottingham Trent and its staff to the lockdown, as well as a huge programme of preparations for the new session in September, not least of which is the issues to be addressed with the arrival of thousands of students into the city. The vital role played by both universities in the city of Nottingham is explored, together with the issues, challenges and benefits that brings for the region, and the ways in which the two institutions are working collaboratively and with other partners under the Universities for Nottingham banner to try to make a difference. There is also consideration of the response of the universities to the issues raised by the Black Lives Matter movement. Do enjoy it. Hello and welcome to this latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time it's my special privilege to welcome Steve Denton. Steve is Registrar COO at Nottingham Trent University, my neighbouring institution. And Steve, it's great to have you here. It'd be really helpful for me to be reminded of your very long career trajectory and how you ended up at Trent. So starting at the beginning, where did it all begin for you?
Hi, Paul, and nice to speak to you. Interesting career. Started, as I think a lot of registrars have, Paul. I was a student union sabbatical, so that was my first introduction, really, to the intricacies of how universities worked. And then I went on from there. I didn't start in universities. I started as a graduate trainee in local government in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, and spent a decade in local government. And that was a time where local government was under huge pressure in terms of financial cuts and changes to the ways that local government worked, which was good experience, actually, for where we are now and what we've been through. Yeah. First experience of universities, I went to what was Thames Valley University as their university secretary in the late 90s. It's now the University of West London. And after a few years there, went to Leeds Met, which is now called Leeds Beckett. You can see an emerging pattern here, Paul, can't you? That anywhere that I've been...
Change their name after you leave.
So I was registrar and secretary there for 10 years. Then moved on to the Institute of Education, which is part of the University of London, as Pro Director, Strategy and Organisation, and worked very closely there with Chris Husbands on the merger with University College London. And then spent 6 months or so at UCL, embedded in the merger. Then took a diversion, did some consultancy work for Higher Education Academy, Leadership Foundation, now Advance HE, before February 2016, ended up in my current post, Chief Operating Officer and Registrar at Nottingham Trent University. So yeah, looking back on it, an interesting career path.
So, which is absolutely fascinating. And, you know, those institutions, which indeed all did change their name after you left them. So your Vice Chancellor must be eagerly awaiting your suggestions about the next name for Nottingham Trent. But I mean, I what was interesting about your Thames Valley and Leeds Met experience, I mean, they were both institutions that had some significant challenges, financial and governance at the time. And I mean, looking back on it, does it feel... I mean, did you learn a lot from them? Were they scary experiences, or was it just feel like business as usual?
Yeah, I learned an enormous amount from both of those. I mean, they were very difficult, very challenging, affected colleagues. I mean, they're slightly different. The Thames Valley one, I mean, I was in my early 30s when I got the university secretary role, and we had a financial challenge. And I think if people can think back that long, a quality challenge at the time. and Hefke had to come in, and we were under special measures. And I think I look back on it now. I think the good thing was I was relatively naive, so the naivety of youth. But I learned an enormous amount there, working with a number of vice chancellors at the time around how you deal with difficulties with rigour, but with compassion. Not forgetting always that at the end of this, there are people who were affected by this, whether that's students or staff. I'd learned a bit more by the time I got to Leeds Met, but I think the one thing I learned there is that you are a role holder, and you have responsibilities. And however difficult that is, sometimes you have to exercise those responsibilities, whatever the personal impact might be, Paul.
Both incredibly challenging. But what I find greatly reassuring about this, and I'm assuming you do as well, is that actually subsequent to that, I mean, both, yeah, as you mentioned, both institutions changed their name, but actually they've gone on to be, you know, they've recovered extraordinarily well from the difficulties that they were in, and I think, as you say, that's really important for the staff, students, alumni, and the communities they're based in. But that does offer real reassurance to other institutions going through challenge that you can recover.
That's right, Paul. And, you know, I have great affinity with what is now University of West London and Leeds Beckett, and an enormous sense of pride, really, about where they are now, the roles that they play with their local communities and local regions, and the opportunities that both those institutions offer, particularly to some of the most disadvantaged members of our society. And they, you know, they both went through very challenging circumstances. So it would have been really tough, wouldn't it, if both those institutions had to fold. There would have been a huge gap, I think, in both of those cities and regions. I think there are lessons there in the current context.
I don't know the extent to which this is true, but one of my perceptions about what was Thames Valley is that one of the challenges it had, it was the product of various mergers of one kind or another, which made bringing things together hard and just helped create an environment of, you know, some stress within the organisation. And, you know, resolving those issues seemed to me to be part of it from the outside. So I wonder, is that true? And then the kind of, you know, how does the merger issue in relation to the Institute of Education and UCL play out very differently from that?
Yeah, I think that's very perceptive, Paul. I mean, at Thames Valley, I mean, it was a creation of the sort of various enforced mergers of 1988 and 1992. So it put together institutions that look geographically as though they made sense, but actually had very different missions, and it wasn't quite the same at Leeds Met, but there was still a difference between the sort of Headingley campus and the city campus, you know, because they come up through different routes and different histories and different cultures. I think at one stage we still had two UCU branches, which was interesting, and that served me well, really. In terms of the merger with UCL, because you have to, mergers don't work without an overriding academic purpose or academic ambition. You can do all sorts of stuff in terms of efficiencies and finances and geographic location, but at the heart of it, you know, we are academic institutions driven by good research and good teaching. And if the merger doesn't make sense from those points of view, Paul, then it just isn't going to work.
You know? Yeah, yeah. And I mean, one of the things about all of those mergers is that they did require, you know, that the kind of sense that they were at some level the right thing to do. And although there may have been an element of, you know, direction about them, it's still a very different scenario from the one that, you know, that people talk about where we are now, where, you know, you're talking about possibly forcing institutions to merge just for, you know, economic survival reasons, which feels like a very, very different scenario.
Yeah, and, you know, I have reservations about that. I think if there are as I say, academic synergies. You can see where bringing two institutions together creates a better experience for students or greater research collaboration, but also achieves efficiencies and savings, then that's great, Paul. But actually, these mergers cost money in the short term, because you have to put in additional resources to make them happen and to see through and embed the merger. And they take an awful long time to embed, as you know, as I said, you know, a decade, 2 decades later, you know, you have two branch trade unions. So yeah, I understand why those things were done in the late 80s, early 90s. But I, you know, who knows whether there'll be mergers or not, and you know, the government's promised a restructuring fund. But at heart, as I keep saying, you know, let's do it for the right reasons. You know, it's right for students and staff and the communities we serve, Paul.
And I mean, I think the money issue is a really important one, because I mean, the biggest, most arguably most successful merger of recent times was Manchester and UMass to form the new University of Manchester. But that, you know, did take a significant level of investment to make it happen. And, you know, and has made a very successful institution, a really, really big one. But it required a lot of investment to make that change. And it took a long time to work it all through. The things that we don't have now are time and money. And, you know, I share your anxiety about the whether or not this is, you know, will actually be the right thing to do. But the there is going to be, I fear, a real kind of strong urgency about some of these, you know, potential mergers and direction from government.
Yeah, I agree with that. And if I think back to the UCL merger, which I led the operational aspects and Chris Husbands led the academic aspects, it was probably 2 years in the formulation, because we spent an awful lot of time, not necessarily on the due diligence and legal stuff, although that took a lot of time, but it was on the consultation, the engagement, outlining the academic business case, consulting various aspects of the community, which was all worth it in the end, because I think the vast majority of colleagues then at UCL and the Institute of Education were convinced it was the right thing to do, and that made the transition smoother. So these things do take time, and they just can't happen overnight.
No, absolutely. And I think that, I mean, looking back, it's often thought that, you know, these things are very, very rare. Actually, as you rightly identified, they do happen all the time. And there was a huge spate of mergers of teacher education colleges in the 70s and early 80s. And also in the late 80s, early 90s, there were nursing colleges all absorbed into universities as well. But again, these things all took time, and you know, it took a long time for them actually to become genuinely fully a part of a higher education institution. And of course, just time is what people think, you know, we haven't got at the moment. So I really do worry that we're gonna rush into changes in institutions that people might regret, and actually will have a negative impact on, you know, the merging institutions and their staff and their students. Because like with your example of Thames Valley, it might look good on paper, it might look good on the map, but in reality, you know, if the cultures don't fit, and it's all being jammed in for the sake of, you know, notional efficiency, you really, really are going to struggle to develop the newly named institution, no matter how attractive the new brand is.
That's right. And if I just reflect on another example, not that I've got a thing about mergers, but when I was at Leeds Met, we'd taken over an FE college in the late 90s that was in some financial difficulty, I think. So I understand the reasons why we did that. But my sense was it didn't fit, and discussed that with the vice chancellor and the board at the time. So I led a demerger of the FE college and transferred it to another large FE provider in the northeast. But it was clear to us there that we'd acquired this college, and there seemed to be good reasons for doing it. You know, the the often cited one is getting a progression route from FE through to HE, but it just didn't operate in practice. It was 20 miles up the road. It was seen as a distant outpost that not many people visited. So it just didn't, you know, there wasn't really any, as I say, academic alignment. And actually, it was a business that we didn't really understand. There are good, yeah, large FE institutions. Whereas in my current place, as you know, we've got, yeah, we've got Brackenhurst, where a lot of thought, I think, was put into, we took over Brackenhurst in, again, the late 90s, but it's clearly integrated into everything we do, and it's got an FE, HE offering, you know, right through to PhD. It's got some great research up there. So it really feels part of the university, yeah, and not, yeah, a separate FE entity. Yeah.
And it's only a kind of locational issue, which is the only point of divergence, really. It's not, you know, it's not anything. It's just a bit far away. That's all.
Yeah. But it is a distinctive part yeah, of our offer, and I don't think we'd contemplate for one moment not being in Brackenhurst.
So moving from the kind of theoretical possibilities of the, you know, the of mergers in the sector as we kind of move out of the immediate first phase of the pandemic response, I wonder, you know, what those first, you know, 3 months of lockdown have felt like from your perspective in terms of, you know, running professional services within Nottingham Trent. I mean, how has it been for you? Because it was a kind of all a very sudden move in late March from, you know, winding down and trying to plan for change. And then suddenly, you know, the whole institution, everyone had to suddenly work remotely almost overnight.
Yeah, I've just done a reflective piece actually for our executive team, and it's going to go through to audit committee and the board. So there are sort of two distinct phases, Paul, aren't there? And I think this has been picked up by other registrars in your conversations, a sort of January through to March piece, and then a March onwards piece. And that first phase, that January through to March, really was sort of incident management leading through eventually just to that decision. Yes, that's it. We had to close. Although I put close in inverted commas because we'd never closed. Guess like you've never closed. Lots of professional services colleagues been keeping essential services going on campus and support for students who couldn't go anywhere else. And I've been incredibly proud of my professional services colleagues, Paul, in the way that they reacted to that, and they've continued to support staff and students then. Who've had to work or study remotely. I mean, one of the things that has never helped, and again, I try not to be too critical, but government's announcements always came on a Sunday night. So probably about 8 o'clock or a Monday night about 8 o'clock. Yeah. So then, you know, we'd be running around, but you never quite knew what was going to happen. Yeah. So you'd be making decisions between 8 p.m. and midnight. And then, you know, in that sort of second phase then, continuing to ensure that we supported students through completing their teaching, through assessment, middle of examination boards, and now thinking about how we're going to bring new and returning students back to campus. Again, an enormous amount of time and effort being put into that, with the real focus on the student experience, and we've been keeping research activities going and bringing more research activities back online. And so this notion really that we're not thinking this through or we're not planning this couldn't be further from the truth from my perspective. Yeah. And talking to other colleagues, the same, an enormous amount of care and effort being put into this in what is still uncertain times, Paul. Yeah. You know, what are the restrictions going to look like in September? Who knows?
I think that's absolutely right, Steve. And I share your pride in the response of colleagues to, you know, what has been an incredibly challenging period. And I think it's one of those great examples that shows the strength and depth of institutions, that people, you know, in every part of the organisation have really pulled together, and everyone's played their part. And that's been absolutely terrific to see. But completely correct in that the next phase, the planning for kind of full reopening and welcoming new and returning students in September is arguably the hardest bit of all of this now, because there is so much uncertainty about what the landscape will look like. Then, you know, will we have quarantine for international students? Will any of the international students actually turn up? You know, will it be 2 meter social distancing or 1 meter social distancing or some other bizarre measurement? And, you know, will we actually have any kind of test and trace arrangements in place? You know, as of the latest announcement, it kind of looks like we're not. So that's going to make, you know, life really, really difficult for all of us. But you've got to have confidence that if anyone can solve these kind of problems, then, you know, then people in universities can. You know, we've got a bunch of people working on, you know, vaccines and preventive approaches. And we've got another bunch of people working on how do we provide education, support, student experience, and a working life for all of our people in these very, very new and uncharted territories.
That's right, and nobody's done this before. As I've said several times. So I think you draw on three things then, Paul, don't you? So in a university, we always draw on information or evidence, what's available at the time, how others are doing things. So constantly looking at government guidance, sharing intelligence with colleagues in other institutions, working on data that you've got internally. So that's always the first thing, and that always continues to get updated. The second thing is working with your colleagues, drawing on experience. So I've got a great team of professional services directors working with me, who've got more expertise in their specific areas than I've got and can draw on other experiences. So consultation and discussion with colleagues. And then third is just then use drawing on your own experience then to use judgment, to sort of inform that. So those are the three things I think all chief operating officers, registrars will be drawing on in to varying degrees, Paul, won't they?
Yeah, it absolutely is what you require in this uncharted territory. Thinking about, I mean, we both live and work in city of Nottingham, and you know, both universities are among the, you know, both the biggest employers in the city, but also we are the ones responsible for bringing in large numbers of students each autumn, and that has a profound effect on, you know, the activities in the city, but also its economy, and, you know, the lifestyle and the culture and the vibrancy of the place. But again, that, you know, we're facing some real challenges there about how, you know, what impact this is going to have. What are the, you know, the year-round citizens of Nottingham going to make of these arrivals come the autumn? And I wonder what your thoughts are on that, because it's, you know, it's not unique to Nottingham. Around the country, universities will be thinking about their relationships with their local communities, and we are, you know, there are always issues at the best of times that we both seek to, you know, to manage and to work with those local communities to reassure, but also to ensure that our students do behave as good citizens. Have you had some thoughts about how that might play out?
Yeah, I've been thinking quite a bit about that, Paul. And as you know, both of our universities are now actively engaged with the city and county authorities and public health authorities, police, fire and rescue service, city council, county council. Because as you say, you know, we could have somewhere in the order of 50 to 60,000 people coming into the city and county in September, and that's bound to have an impact. I think the good thing, Paul, is I think everybody starts off from the positive position that the two universities are absolutely key to the economic recovery of the city and the county. So actually bringing those 60,000 students in is a good thing in terms of the economy of Nottingham and Nottinghamshire. But what we've got to do then is do that in a planned way, because, you know, we can do a lot in terms of how we implement social distancing in our teaching spaces, our learning spaces, in our accommodation. But our students will go out and they'll go into the city and the county. And so we're working quite closely now with those authorities about, well, what is the impact then on licensed premises, restaurants, open spaces? And I think we've got a role to play there in giving good information and advice to new and returning students about, I mean, we've always done this, Paul, haven't we, in terms of our expectations, but supplementing that with our expectations in the new circumstances that we find ourselves in. So I think we deal with that through support, advice and guidance for new and returning students. And then dealing with the very, very small minority, as we usually do, and it usually ends up with you and I, of difficulties. And you know, as you say, in normal circumstances, you and I have got to deal with, you know, the sometimes the adverse impacts that our students can have on local communities. But I, we don't shy away from that. We recognise that. But I think, you know, it's going to be particularly acute in the autumn. So being prepared for that is very important.
Yeah, and I think your earlier point there about the sense in which there is recognition of the benefits that our universities bring to the economies of the city and county, I think is a really powerful one, and I do think that that's really important because you know it. It hasn't always been the way that we've been viewed so positively, but I worry that our national government doesn't quite see universities in such a positive light at the moment. And despite the contributions that we're making from, you know, from student nurses and doctors being part of the frontline response through to our researchers helping, you know, find a vaccine, etc., etc. It still seems that, you know, government actually doesn't really think that universities are such a big deal after all. And that we're not really, you know, a massive part of the economy, which, of course, we are. And, you know, locally and nationally, as well as internationally, we are absolutely critical to the success of the United Kingdom. And do you think that, you know, we are struggling to get our recognition, or do you think secretly government does understand us?
Yeah, I'm a bit more optimistic about it. I mean, and again, if I'm trying to be charitable to government, they're dealing with an uncharacteristic. Yeah, but they're dealing with a set of circumstances that no other government's had to deal with before. And if I was in their position, I'd be dealing with health first and foremost. And I guess they think September's a long way away and universities are probably tomorrow's problem. But as you know, an enormous amount of work being done with both of our vice chancellors actually leading various aspects through UUK to work with government about the support that can be provided to universities. And how we can provide a great experience for students in 2020-21. I think where we've got an advantage, Paul, is we'd already started the collaborative work under Universities for Nottingham and had been engaging with in a collaborative way as well as our individual ways with various organisations in the city and county. And that, I think that had got some real resonance and some real traction. So I think, yes, it is important for us to have that sort of national recognition, but it's crucially important that we've got that sort of regional county and city recognition and support as well, Paul, because that's where we have, you know, we have national and international impact, but we have huge impact regionally and locally.
Absolutely right. And I think I know, you know, my university has arguably in the past, you know, neglected the local at the expense of the international, but is, like you, absolutely focused on working together with our partners in the city and county to address that issue. And I think that, I mean, there is a really vital additional dimension to this following the George Floyd killing and the Black Lives Matter movement And the way that that has, sparked huge movements around race equality in a way that, hadn't taken off in quite the way it has. But I think universities have to be, front and centre in addressing issues of race inequality in this country. And in the city of Nottingham, which is, it's a diverse city, both our universities, I think, will have a really important role to play in that. And okay, we don't have, many statues between us, but, we do have history. And, I think between us, we absolutely have to address that, but also ensure that, we do the right things for our students and our staff and try and address those inequalities that are still, transparent for all to see, although we may have neglected them until our eyes were better opened recently.
Yeah, I agree with that. And we've got the statue of Brian Clough, which I don't think anybody's taking offence to at the moment. But I think both of our vice chancellors made very powerful statements, Paul, haven't they, recently about this? And certainly from our point of view, we've done a lot of good work on under our sort of Success for All banner in terms of reducing the gap on attainment and employability for students from different groups. We've got the Black Leadership Programme for students. We've made some real inroads into the percentage of BAME professoriate. But, Edward, my Vice Chancellor, has recognised that there's still an enormous amount to do. So we mustn't rest on our laurels.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we all in the sector have a long way to go. But, these are now issues at the top of the agenda, which is great to see and long overdue. Steve, we need to stop there, but listen, thank you very much indeed for the discussion. Hugely appreciated. Great to hear about your background, but also your experiences at Trent in what remain very, very challenging circumstances for us all. So thank you again. Great to talk.
Thanks, Paul.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course, and if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until the next time.